Okay, so it's quite hot today. So I thought I'd give a talk about the hell realms. Burning fire and stuff. Do you want to hear about that? No. No, instead of what's external. In Buddhism, we focus more on what's internal. How we can deal with no matter what is happening to us to make our lives a bit more peaceful. And one of the forms of suffering which I was going to talk about today was about just how trying to live up to other people's expectations, how to please others, causes us so much suffering. Even today, I saw these two girls come into our monastery. They needed a blessing for something. And I saw them there. This is like winter time. And they had this like high jumpers, low strung jeans or whatever it was. They had so much exposed flesh around their midriff. It must have been freezing. But what do people do that for? You know, Bodhinyana Monastery is not a nightclub. So you don't go there to try and capture guys or whatever. But I was really quite concerned for them. It reminded me of just going in Melbourne many years ago in the middle of the winter and wear low-strung jeans or skirts and high, I don't know what they're called, halter tops or something. I don't know what they were called. But you saw all these ladies with so much exposed flesh. And it was going blue. And they were doing that for fashion. So why do people do that? They cause themselves so much suffering to try and please others and cause themselves so much physical problems. So instead of doing stuff like that, it's not just physical, it's just like emotional. Why do people try even to have this idea they have to fit in? Look at the monks and the nuns. Bald-headed women, bald-headed monks. Do we fit in? Now maybe we could say we do because we've been here long enough. But when I first came here, oh my goodness, to see, actually say a monk, people didn't know who I was. What are you? And I remember just one morning, because you know I was doing most of the building, filling up our combi van, this is about 39 years ago, filling up our combi van with all of the building material from Perth and taking it down over to Serpentine to build our monastery. And I was working really hard, and then, just about finished, this about 14-year-old girl came out from the house next door. She was visiting her auntie. And she came out and looked at me, and she put her hands on her hips like this, and she looked me up and down with as much disgust as a 14-year-old girl can generate. And she said to me, "You're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck." And I think that almost like the exact word she said to me. And I couldn't help it. I just burst out laughing. That's not what she expected. It was really funny. It's simply because you've never seen anybody like this before. Or just just laughing today because we've got a new governor coming up in Western Australia soon. And so I got my invite to his inauguration ceremony. And you know, the invitation, you know, in Government House over here, there was a nice invitation, but it said that I had to wear business suit, business attire. And that also just, of course you can get in there because they know me by now. It also just made me laugh, just why it is that many of the things we have here, the idea of like wearing robes in many parts of the world, you know, especially over in maybe the East Coast much more than the West Coast here, people don't know who you are. You don't fit in. And so sometimes some people say, well, you're going to sort of a big function. Why don't you wear ordinary clothes? Can you get a suit or a brown suit or something? Wear a wig on top of your head so you don't stand out or whatever. And of course, there's no way you're going to do anything like that. this is who you are, and you are happy to be a monk. So I don't care if you stand out, this is who you are, and this is who you will be. So in a while, you're not really ashamed, you're not embarrassed, you're not at all concerned what other people think of you. And what I found, that confidence is what really comes across. The confidence that you are a person who's at ease with themselves. Even these days, more people know who Buddhists are. I told this story to some people today because they were here for the funeral of one of their friends who passed away. He used to come here every Friday. And that they were all into martial arts. And of course they were asking, Ajahn Brahm, now you're a Buddhist monk, meditator, do you do martial arts? I don't, never trained in martial arts. I can fake martial arts. And that's what I did once. I told him the story of when I was over in London visiting my mother. And that's where I grew up in London, in West London, Acton. Part of that area is very rough. And I just, in the afternoon, I was walking from my mother's house, or rather flat, apartment, to the Sri Lankan temple to give a talk that evening. And I decided to go the shortest way, which was also past this block of flats for poor people, which was known as a hotbed of crime. Basically, it was like a no-go area, unless you knew who you were and where, and the other people knew you. So I was walking along the street, minding my own business, and this gang, maybe first of all a dozen or maybe 14 or 15 guys, came out just to meet together to, you know, find out what business they were going to get up to that evening. And as they saw me coming towards them, just walking peacefully, minding my own business, then they realized I was a Buddhist monk because they started chanting, Buddha, 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 Buddha. As I got closer, it became louder and faster. Buddha, 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 Buddha. They were trying to intimidate me. But even though I was alone, and these were many young, you must call them thugs, just they were waiting for me, chanting louder and louder, Buddha, Buddha. I had a choice. I could turn around and just go back and go another way. I could cross the road to the other side of the street. That is not my character. My character was that I walked towards them calmly. When I got to within about 5 or 6 meters of them, they were really chanting loud now, Buddha, 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 Buddha. And I raised my arms in a kung fu pose. At least what I saw on the TV as a kung fu pose. You know, sometimes, I actually did that. Sometimes, I don't know if it was stupidity or courage, but I don't know, but it worked. And I just walked at the same pace with my arms like this. And they parted and let me right through. They didn't hit me at all or harm me at all. They could have wasted me so easily. And I didn't know anything about kung fu. I just knew how to play the game and to be confident. I think that was the most important thing. I didn't mind what they thought of me, because I was just going off to do a good thing, going to a temple. And I remember learning from occasions like that. I don't care what other people think of me. I'm going to enjoy myself, give a talk, have fun, and just, if you like it, great. If you don't like it, even better. I can have an early night and I won't be invited back next week. I can take more of a rest. But anyway, that all came from something which I read many, many years ago. And that was, some great philosopher said that when you are, you know, in your teens, you know, you're trying to find a partner in life, you're really, really concerned what other people think of you. That's why you can see young ladies, young men, they spend so much money on clothes, you know, on their hair, on their speech, trying to be skillful and cool in whatever they do in life. And they spend so much time worrying what other people think of you. when you get to middle age, you know, you get your confidence. In middle age, you couldn't give a damn what other people think of you. You're going to do it anyway. You're a confident person. And then when you get to my age, you know, in the 70s or even 60s, you finally figure out that people weren't thinking about you anyway. They're only thinking about themselves most of the time. So realizing that you don't have to worry too much what other people think of you. You don't have to try so hard to fit in. And you don't have to worry if you're rejected, if you don't fit in. And so many people get really concerned. They don't fit into this world. They got no friends. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing in life. They don't get acknowledgements from others. It's not like you're not famous, but just, you know, where do you fit into this world? And of course, after a while, you realize you don't have to fit in. But you do anyway. Everybody fits in. And people will be, if they were honest with each other, honest how they feel, they wouldn't be trying so hard to be something they're not. And they're at ease with themselves. It's great having good friends. Because I've been here in this Buddhist society of Western Australia for such a long time now, almost 40 years. So actually, it's over 40 years now. 41 or 42 years. Crikey. So anyway, because I've been here a long time, that you get to know most of you. You know who I am, I know who you are. And so because of that trust which we have, we don't have to try hard to be something we're not. We can just be at ease with each other. And that's always a sign of a good friend. A good friend can disagree with you, but you don't have an argument. Have you got good friends like that? You got partners. I mentioned this just a little bit earlier before I came in here, that you can love your mother or your father unconditionally, no matter what they do. It's very rare that a mother or father acts so badly that you can't stand them anymore and you have to run away. But your partners in life, the ones you choose to marry and live with, you spend so much time just trying to choose the right one. And can you love them like you can love your mother or love your father? Have you got the same sort of unconditional love towards your partner as you have towards your parents? I've noticed this all the time, even my parents. My father, you know, sometimes, you know, wouldn't agree with him. But you always loved him. There's no way you'd ever just want to divorce your father or your mother at the time. And it's really weird. But then you try to find a partner in life, your standards are so much higher. You know, you ask so much more from the person, you know, you commit to. Why is that? And after a while, if you can love your mother or you love your father, and they're not perfect, you don't choose them, but you have this bond together, this caring, this unconditional part of the love, and that's beautiful to see. I don't know why people can't do that with the person they've shared rings with. But anyway, so not the rings, I call them handcuffs. Is that right? The rings of marriage? What are the three rings of marriage? You remember that story? The three rings of marriage? First ring of marriage is the engagement ring. Second ring, Dennis knows this one, because he used to be the marriage celebrant of the Buddhist Society. Did this many times. I even remember once when we did a marriage, and he was just about to declare the husband and wife, husbands and wives, your marriage is complete. And then I had to nudge him. Do you remember that, Dennis, when I nudged you and said, you forgot to exchange the rings? Oh, yes, thank you. But anyway, we did that before you actually declared them husband and wife, so thank you, Dennis. But anyway, the second ring of marriage is the wedding ring. And what's the third ring of marriage? Can't hear you. You say suffering? No, Dennis, caring. I've changed to become more soft in my old age. But yeah, why is it? You know, people laugh at that joke about was it engagement ring, wedding ring, and suffering? And it shouldn't be that way, should it? Because why do we make such a problem out of these things? Because we have unrealistic expectations of other people. And I mention that because we also have unrealistic expectations of ourselves. As we look at others, so we look at ourselves. And that unrealistic expectation, we try so hard. What for? What do you really want in life? And that's one of the reasons that story about Gandhi, there's all these lovely stories, I don't know if they're true or not, but it's just a good story anyway, that Gandhi was challenged by his professor of law. Mr. Gandhi, if you were walking down the street and you saw these two big bags, one contained money and the other contained wisdom, which one would you take up? You can only take one up and take away with you, money or wisdom. And Gandhi said, I would take the money. That's a trouble with you students these days. You only think of money. And Gandhi replied, sir, we always take that which we don't have. Implying very easily that Gandhi was a poor student, but his professor had no wisdom. It's turning things a different way around. But anyway, a lot of times, why is it that we're not at peace with ourselves and worrying what other people would say? Trying to prove our point to be kind when we're not, rich when we're not. Why do we always in control of what we think other people want of us? And one of the nice things about being a monk, because we, you know, in a community, spiritual community, we live with each other for such a long time, you know, not sort of 24/7, but we meet each other. And I've found it an important part of the monastic life, the spiritual life, that after a while you finally can be friends with anybody. Some of the people who ordain, or some people I ordain, I choose to ordain. Sometimes after I've done the ordination, this is being honest, Venerable Serrato, I'm not talking about you. But you think, okay, he's mentioning my name, it must be me. No, sometimes afterwards I go back to my room and say, what did I ordain him for? And no, I said no, because everyone deserves that chance. And it's a wonderful, over so many years, you know, you have this friendship with one another. You don't choose which one's going to ordain, it's who wants to ordain. And you let them in, and they become really good friends. Sometimes people say, before they ordain as monks or as nuns, they say, please don't ordain that monk. And then after a while they become best of friends. It's wonderful to see just how human beings, with a bit of training and encouragement, can almost be friendly with anybody. And I mention that with anybody in a very wide sense, and how living together, we can learn from one another. This is not sort of like a nice high-minded goal, but the reality. We do learn from each other. We can't escape from each other. And we get better. We grow in wisdom and kindness and tolerance. I was looking at sort of one of the booklets which we printed years ago. Yeah, we have nice booklets about Dhamma and deep meditation and enlightenment and all that sort of stuff. But part of that is not just one's own personal practice, but how that personal practice and personal development relates to one's relationships with others. And being a monk, you don't get married, but being a senior monk, you have to make contact with people of different faiths and different religions, especially here in Perth. And many years ago, I really thought that I should really get out there to make contact with people of other faiths. So maybe I might be wrong. I want to find out from others how they look at the world. So first of all, I thought of starting a football team. So we could actually play the opposition. You know, that's a wonderful way. Instead of just sitting down talking about stuff, doing stuff together. So I really thought of starting a Buddhist football team. So we could play the Catholics or the Muslims or, you know, whoever else would want to. But then I thought, you know, whatever we do, we have to actually make it according to Buddhist principles. So then I thought, a Buddhist footy team, how does that work? We would never tackle anybody, because that's violent. We don't want to disappoint anybody by taking the ball off them. That's taking what is not given. That's against our second precept. And the last thing we want to do is to disappoint somebody by winning the game. So we'd always lose on purpose, just out of kindness, compassion. That's showing the compassionate, gentle side. What does it say here? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. It doesn't say win at all costs, like any football team would do. So I decided that wouldn't work to have a footy. And then I also thought of, this is actually, I learnt a lot from these sorts of ideas, that if you want to make contact with other people, just again, talking is not enough. So I remember this story of these, what was it? It was a Buddhist monk, a Christian, and what was the other one? It was a rabbi. That's right. And they were trying to get some contact with each other, trying to learn from one another. So they had discussions, and they had tea. They wanted something a bit more interesting. So they started playing cards together, you know, just to find some more friendship together. And then the cards turned to gambling, and then that was illegal. So somebody dobbed them in, told the police, and the three of them were arrested. The Buddhist monk, the Christian priest, and the Jewish rabbi. So they had to appear before the judge. And the judge said, you know, you're all sort of people of faith. So, no, first of all, just the Christian priest, you were found gambling. Are you guilty? I just ask you, make it quick and simple, because you're supposed to be honest. You know what the Christian priest did? So fast, the judge didn't catch him. He looked up in the sky and said, Jesus, forgive me, and said, no. He said, okay, you can go. Then they asked the rabbi. The rabbi couldn't say that. So the rabbi crossed his fingers behind his back and said, no, I wasn't gambling. Did you ever do that when you were at school? I don't know why they say that, but if you cross your fingers behind the back, it means you can say whatever. So keep your fingers in front, please. So anyway, then they asked the monk. He said, and by now the judge was getting a bit suspicious of these religious people. So you don't believe in Jesus or God, monk, so you can't sort of ask forgiveness there. Keep your hands in front so you don't cross your fingers behind the back. So monk, were you gambling? And the monk said to the judge, with whom? You can't gamble by yourself. But anyway, just learning just how to fit in and learning just how to be at ease. One of the most wonderful times of in this particular area of learning just how to fit in with other people as a Buddhist monk was when we used to have these meetings over with the Anglican priests over St. George's Cathedral. And actually the reason why this center exists is because when we were looking to get a center here, we decided to, we found this place over here. There wasn't that many people coming here, and the Anglicans were moving up the road. So this place was for sale. I remember when we asked, can we buy it? And they said, no, who's buying it? And they said, oh, the Buddhist monks. And for the Buddhist Society of West Australia. And they said, yes, certainly, no problem. Because we'd been kind to them, they respected us. Otherwise they'd say, no, this was a consecrated site. And that's one of the reasons why some years ago, the dean at the time was, that's right, John Phillips. Phillips, was it? Anyway, he was the Dean of St. George's Cathedral. He invited me to give the sermon on a Sunday Eucharist, I think it was called. And he should know what he was talking about. He was a boss in that cathedral. He said it was the first time that a non-Christian had ever given the Sunday sermon in a cathedral in the world in 2,000 years. I thought, wow, that's really neat. Because of that, I got on TV beforehand, and I remember just Channel 7 or 9, I forget which one it was, and when I went there to do an interview beforehand, you know what happened? They said you have to do makeup first of all. And I said, well, has anybody ever refused? And they said, I think Noel Gallagher from some pop group? Oasis, okay, yeah. He's the only one who refused makeup. I didn't really want to be put in the same category. So they did quick makeup. And the worst part of that, I remember, was Ajahn Bhumani was accompanying me that weekend, and he was laughing his head off, making signs of the... It's really mean to me, but I forgave him. It was good fun. But anyway, just as a result of that, we did this big talk over in St. George's Cathedral. And that was, I really remember that for a long time, because the place was packed. And it was standing room only, in the aisles everywhere. And that the point was, no one knew who was a Christian, who was a Buddhist, and no one really cared. Because people were together, were listening to a talk, an inspiring talk, learning how to let everybody fit in. I don't really believe in rejecting anybody. Not saying you can't come in because you don't look right, or because you're disfigured, or because you're schizophrenic, or whatever. Please let people come in. Let them belong, whoever they are. You might not agree with them, but they can always come in and receive your kindness and friendship. That is something which is wonderful. Even over here, we don't have this problem this time of the year, but in the summertime, sometimes people come in, be honest with it, they've hardly got any clothes on. They come here first of all to listen to a talk, and then they go to the nightclub. I remember going to a funeral service. I mentioned this because I was at a funeral service over in Frio last Wednesday, and it was for a bikey funeral. No, it was real bikies. One of their members had hit a lamppost and died, and their mother was a Buddhist and invited me to come to the funeral to support her. In the end, I ended up doing the funeral service. One of the best funerals I've ever done, because no bikies. No, they came in all their leathers and chains and whatever else they had on, and all their girlfriends, again, came as if they were going to a dance or a nightclub, not a funeral. They're all dressed up. That was their culture. But I looked a bit weird as well to them because I was dressed in brown, and I ended up doing the funeral service. But there was I always remember it because after the funeral service was concluded, they all came up to me, "Nice service, sir. Thank you for that, sir." They were just so polite. It totally changed my idea of bikey. Just I was on their side that day because supporting their grief and their shock. But anyway, that's when you include people and you don't sort of put people out. That it's a much nicer society. That's one of the reasons every time I've been into a prison, to teach the prisoners, every other one of those prisoners feel they are excluded, they don't belong to society, they've been rejected. Yeah, they have done some terrible things, but nevertheless, I don't think that's a reason to have total exclusion of people. If you don't trust anybody, then they will never live up to any sort of trust. They'll feel they're excluded, they feel they belong, they feel they've got no stake in society. So even when people do make mistakes, I always say, learn from mistakes. Don't exclude yourself from mistakes. You have some sort of injury, please. Don't need to exclude yourself because you're injured. You're having cancer treatment. You don't need, here anyway, you don't need to wear a wig or wear a cloth around your head. No, I never do that. Neither do the nuns. Why is it people feel they would be rejected? They have to cover up their injuries or whatever. No, you don't need to be feel excluded there at all. And even people, I learned this from those villages in Thailand. There was one lady in the village, a lovely lady, but she had some sort of injury when she was born, and she was mentally impaired, brain damage. But even though she was brain damaged, she couldn't speak any Thai, certainly not any English, a village girl, but she would always grunt. And her grunts, she'd grown up with her sisters the same age, all her friends knew exactly what grunt meant which. And that's a special language she had with her friends. And she was almost at ease with her friends. She would go out to dances and stuff with her friends, have a wonderful life. She wasn't sort of sectioned aside in some institution for people who couldn't speak or were brain damaged. So other parts about her were wonderful. She had a beautiful life. And I was very impressed with how people included her in rather than excluding them. So she didn't really worry about the things she couldn't do. In other areas, she was brilliant. And I love remembering her because she was responsible for one of the greatest acts of kindness and generosity I've seen. Because I was like, you know, monks, we do work, we don't just sit around all day doing nothing. That's what I should be doing. But anyway, I was just sweeping the hall in this monastery in Thailand. That was my job. I was just behind a cupboard when I heard somebody try and sneak into our main hall. And I just peeked around. It was this girl. It wasn't a thief. You know, I knew her because I'd been in that monastery for years. And she was sneaking into the hall. She couldn't speak. She was, you know, brain damaged. But she was in there by herself, and I wonder what the heck she was up to. She never saw me. She went up to the shrine. She put something on the shrine. And then as soon as she put it on the shrine, she did her little Buddhist bows, and then she ran away as fast as she could so she wouldn't be seen. But she was seen. I saw everything. And I thanked her for what I saw. I went up to the shrine. She made a paper folded into like a lotus and offered it in front of the Buddha statue. No one could ever call it a work of art, but it certainly was a work of kindness. It was the best she possibly could do. You didn't need to be a mind reader to know how she was thinking. She wanted to give it to the shrine, to the Buddha, and she thought if she'd come when other people were there, they'd have thrown it away. It's not beautiful enough for the Buddha, but it's the best she could possibly do. When I saw that, to me it was beautiful. Not because of what it looked like, but where it came from and how hard it was for her to do that. And so afterwards I told all the monks, you know, I wasn't a senior monk there, but I said to them, look, that little paper flower which was handmade on the shrine, if anybody tries to throw that away, I'm not a violent monk, but I will sort of really sort of fight against you because I know where that came from and how beautiful that was to have a person who felt they were rejected, but they managed to find a way in and give a gift, the best they could possibly do. It's not just like putting a flower on there which you can buy from the shop. She made this thing. And those are the sorts of things which inspire me. When you actually include people, they feel they belong and they can offer things. And you learn a lot from them and they learn a lot from you. And we become much closer together as a community. And also it reflects on what you do. You know, we often ask for volunteers. Little Bill at the back over there, always working hard on it. Always the last one out, usually on a Friday. And you don't have to be perfect to be a volunteer. It's just including you, doing the best you possibly can. That's more than good enough. It's the kindness makes it beautiful, not the fact that you can sweep without leaving any sort of dust or anywhere on the carpet. It's the kindness which is most important. which means that when you, if you're looking for a partner, you can't find one. You don't have to have a perfect one, for goodness sake. If you demand a perfect partner, then they'll be stressed out, trying to please you, worried what you might think. They're trying their best. Most people generally do try their best in life. They really want to try and help and do the right thing. So if they make a mistake, just close your eyes, turn the other way, and just say, what a wonderful job that was. It's a very good job you did. A good job that you did it, not me, because I'm too lazy. Whatever, then you manage to create more sense of inclusion. And that goes again for you personally. When you feel you don't have to try so hard to please others, and you don't have to try so hard to please yourself, you can relax more. You don't have to be perfect. Then you find all these people who were fully enlightened monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha. You think these must be some supermen from the Marvel, is it Marvel Universe or whatever it is, the Marvel Comics? They weren't. They were ordinary human beings, but made peace with themselves. And were not afraid. They didn't want anything anymore. They were at peace. Imagine that. You don't have to be perfect. People who were dwarfs, people who were serial killers, people who had done all sorts of crazy stuff. Always remember that woman, Patachara her name was. And she was a hero to me because, you know, she lost her mother, father, her two baby kids and her husband on the same day. And it drove her out of her mind, literally. And she didn't know where to go, she had no home. She lost everything. And she just happened by chance, good karma you might say, to wander in to a sermon where the Buddha was teaching in the Jetavana monastery. Sometimes people find it hard to love themselves. That's one of the biggest challenges of our modern world. We always think we should improve ourselves. But how many of you can be at peace with yourself? To open the door of your heart to yourself exactly as you are right now. It's more than good enough. Don't exclude any part of yourself. Let yourself be. Find how much relaxing that is, how much at ease that is, how much at peace that is. You don't try and just think that life should be better or this should be better. You're living a pretty good life. Each one of you. Yeah, you have your problems and difficulties. But when you look at the positive sides of things, it's pretty good. Each one of you. You worry about too much and you don't appreciate as much as you could all the people who are around you and the kindness and the good weather and enough food to eat and the ability to enjoy your life. There's so many positives about this world. And there's so many positives about the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Brilliant society. So I don't know why we have, can I say this? I don't know why we have committee meetings. What are we trying to improve? It's pretty good, our Buddhist Society. I belong to many other Buddhist societies in the world, and many of the Buddhist societies in this world would just, oh, I would love to have an organization like this and all our assets and all the monks and nuns which we have living in peace and harmony. It's pretty amazing. So, yeah, we need to keep it. What's the best way to keep things? To care for them and let them grow and to acknowledge, embrace and let people be, no matter who they are. Just like I remember this one person. As I saw the lady over there, I thought she was going to lay down, she was a bit tired. But remember one of the ladies was lying down during the meditation many years ago, and she fell fast asleep during my meditation. That's okay. But then she started snoring loudly. I always remember that, because this lady was snoring so loud, the people next to her, shh, get up, you're disrespecting the Buddha, you're pointing your feet at the Buddha, or whatever it was. And then afterwards I gave a talk about that. And I said, look, that lady, you know, she talked to me before she came in. She was a victim of quite severe domestic abuse. And she said when she came in here, she felt safe. She didn't need to sort of live up to her partner's unrealistic and aggressive demands. She could just be, and she felt so at peace here that she lay down and had a nap. I said, next time that happens, just get her a blanket or something, get her a pillow. I don't mind them sleeping during my talk or during my meditation. It's a wonderful thing she did there. Please be more accepting, more open, letting people be. Disturb it for others. It's not the noise disturbs you, said Ajahn Chah, it's always you disturb the noise. That's what they did then. So anyway, they learned from that. We learned from it to be more accepting and more open, let people in. Okay, I did flag this at the very beginning, I talk too much, so I better end up now with this talk. So now at the end of the talk we usually do what? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Which means awesome. Okay, now we've got any questions? First of all from the floor, anyone? Question from the floor? My goodness. They must all be enlightened. This is very nice questions. No questions? Thank you. So the questions are over now, we can actually... No. 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 Aha. I've zapped it, so it won't have any questions. Okay. Oh my goodness. From Singapore. Oh no, I've got a serious question here. What happens to the five aggregates, the five khandhas, after one becomes awakened? I don't know what you mean by the word awakened. You mean when you get up in the morning? No, I don't think they mean that. I mean the idea of when they're enlightened. If the false idea of a self is eradicated at arahat, what happens to the five aggregates when you become enlightened? In other words, you attain, that's the wrong word, but you experience nibbana. That means that the five aggregates are in their disentangling mode. That's just one way of putting it. You're disappearing. The cause of that process continuing has been taken out, and that illusion of a self, and that means you will continue until you die, and when you die, that's when the five aggregates, and those five aggregates of the body, experience, that's my translation of Vedana, perception, a will is a main part of sankhara, and consciousnesses. You know, I don't make a point of never saying consciousness, because consciousness refers to the sixth consciousness, mind consciousness. All those consciousnesses cease without remainder. Nothing more comes up. It's the last part of it. Nothing gets destroyed, because there's only a process. This process is now finished. There's nothing disappears, but just the process ends. And that's full nibbana, called pari-nibbana. The word pari means complete, total, with nothing remaining. So the five aggregates, they vanish. They've done their job. From Melbourne. Good evening, Ajahn. Good evening in Melbourne. I'm wondering what... Actually, good night. It's a couple of hours later. I'm wondering what aspect of existence it is which carries one's karma between lives. Much respects and gratitude. You don't need a place where it's stored. It's almost like enfolded into one's existence. A good example of that is when you have like a mango from this life to its next life as a tree and then another mango. That mango-ness is karma as a mango, not as an apple. Where is that stored? In the DNA? But the DNA is always changing. You know that in a new mango, there's probably no atom in the old mango present in a new mango. So where was the karma of being a mango, being sweet, being this type of mango, another type of mango stored? That just shows a limited imagination, a limited understanding of the nature of this process, which is also exhibited in one mango having a seed which leads to another mango tree and other mangoes. Nothing is stored in there. It's just, even I always say the brains are plastic, everything is always changing. But it's just, sometimes I always struggling hard to find similes. It's like a river. You look at the River Swan, just going over that bridge today again, coming here from Serpentine. As you go over that bridge, it always looks the same every week, every Friday, but of course it's always different water flowing in that river. But the banks are always pretty much the same. It's like the banks, what guides that flow of water. That's almost like karma. It channels it, can go this way, not another way. But the water is, your five aggregates and what you take as your body and mind. That is always flowing, never the same today as it was last week. Probably hardly even a molecule of water in there today, which was there last week when I came over it last time. But nevertheless, it looks the same because it's channeled in that direction. But every now and again, there's a flood or a drought, or the government decides to make another channel somewhere with big bulldozers. So that karma is not permanent also. Sometimes that is also changed, adjusted. So those are similes. But the aspect of existence which carries one's karma between lives is nothing which carries it. It's just almost implicit, in that direction which one is going. The other thing about karma, which I love to say, is that when you do any bad karma, you don't just get it back one by one. If you sort of hit a nun, you don't get hit back 100 times or 1,000 times. It's more than that, a million times or something. When you do a good act of karma, it comes back to you many times. A bad act of karma comes back many times. So if you do the maths, remember, I was a mathematician, physicist, before I became a monk. You've done so much bad karma, each one of you, you included Venerable Soroto, and me. There's no way we can pay it all back. It's too much. But you've also done so much good karma. There's no way you can exhaust it all. Just one good, kind act that gets paid back millions of times over. So if we've got such a store of good karma, such a store of bad karma, why does one type of karma come into fruition and other types don't? And I think you can understand why. It's right now. What is your mind state like? If you've got a bad mind state, it's like you're attracting bad karma from the past. And that's why when you're in a miserable mood, more bad things happen to you. But if you can be in a good mood, a kind mood, it's amazing how many good things happen to you. You're like attracting your store of good karma from the past. Karma is an amazing thing. You've got so much good karma, each one of you. From Borneo, you said that thinking gets in the way of meditation, but we need to think when we listen to Dhamma. Do you? How should we view thinking? Should we always train it to see positive in everything? No, sometimes that thinking will always be discriminative. You can't see the positive in everything. You see negative sometimes, or less positive. Look, even the COVID tests. We had a few COVID outbreaks in Bodhinyana Monastery last week, and the monks were very positive. When they took the rat test, it came out positive. So it's not good to be positive in everything. They're okay though, we're getting through it. So, but when the thinking about it, a lot of time the thinking about it doesn't help at all. Because the thought is so conditioned and brainwashed by culture, by your upbringing. If you are fully enlightened, then fine, you can trust thinking. But if you're not, it's based on stuff which you're seeing things which aren't really there. I've said before about the flower pot experiment that was done in Imperial College in London. They got a flower pot to levitate. People who actually saw it, these were physicists, they said it didn't happen. It did happen. They refused to admit it because it's impossible, but it did happen. It was a trick. There was like a electromagnet under the bench, but they didn't realize that it did actually levitate. But they said, I didn't see it, it was on the table all the time. And that's a very good example of we see only what we want to see. And even our bare perceptions are often distorted. And we think based upon our perceptions. That's why thinking is not an accurate description of reality. It's much better to be still. Basically, this is the talk on Sunday on the Nalakapana Sutta. That's one of the reasons I'm mentioning that. It's a simple sutta, but it's where the Buddha states categorically that the only way to overcome these things we call the five hindrances is actually through jhanas, deep meditations. Without those hindrances disappearing, then what you see, what you hear, is not reliable. We see what we want to see. We block out in denial of what we don't want to see, what's challenging for us. It's one of the reasons. The only place you can find trust in your senses is when the five hindrances have been removed. That's the basic requirement to get enlightenment. Well, it's all about meditation. How do you live life as a meditation teacher? Helping people makes me happy, and your meditation inspires me to give, to care more than my previous paid job. But I'm struggling with how to feed my family and charging my students. Please advise. The best way, of course, is to be a monastic. This is actually where we're supposed to be the teachers of meditation. It's all set up for this. We don't have a family to feed. Oh, I do have a family to feed. All the other monks and nuns and all of you building monasteries and building retreat centers and stuff and this place. But it's all done through donations. We never charge for anything. So a meditation teacher, if you are a meditation teacher, part of meditation is learning how to renounce. Renounce is actually giving up, giving away things, freeing yourself from stuff. So that's actually where you have a family. It's tough being a meditation teacher with a family. But in the time of the Buddha, when people did have meditation, they got very deep, they had to give up their family. Not because it was required by some law, because they felt they had a bigger family now. So basically you're in the wrong job. If you want to be a meditation teacher, be a monastic. That's what it was set up for. Why did the Buddha set up these monks and nuns? Please explain what happens to one's consciousness when somebody passes away. Please explain the different stages. Do they vary according to someone's karma? Of course they do. So that when you're... These are not the usual questions we have on a meditation. It's really weird. But anyway, I'll answer them. Your consciousness six consciousnesses: sight consciousness, sound consciousness, smell, taste, touch, and mind consciousness. And the mind consciousness is not always there. Sometimes if you're seeing, the mind consciousness stops for a little while. So your mind consciousness can be seen, as the Buddha said, rising one moment is one thing, passing away the next moment. It's not stable. It's not some like screen which is always there. Sometimes that's what happens when you get into deep meditations. It's like you're seeing a TV screen which has always been there for you, and suddenly it's not that the screen goes blank, the whole TV vanishes. The TV's not there. Even mind consciousness stops, disappears. In the deep meditations you see that, you come out afterwards, that's weird, but that happened. Exactly what the Buddha said. So when somebody passes away, if they're fully enlightened, all those consciousnesses stop and they don't arise again. An ordinary person, once you are passed away, your mind consciousness creates an image of the previous consciousness, what they call mind-made consciousness. So it creates almost like a body with all the features as it was before, what they call like spirits and ghosts. Happens to most people when you die, that consciousness creates like a mind-made body consciousness. It's happened so often, it's weird, but please, again, I apologize for going over time, but one of the gentlemen here, he had a friend in Kalgoorlie who was a builder. The builder got cancer, and the friend invited the builder to come to Bodhinyana Monastery for some counseling about dying. And of course, eventually, the builder died. And even when he visited me the best clothes he possibly could have, which was always like thongs and shorts and a singlet. That's all the clothes he would wear. And then when he died, it was a closed coffin. Of course, I never went there, it was done in Kalgoorlie, but my friend who lived over here did. And then, a few days later, friend was woken up in the middle of the night. Somebody had poked him. He thought it was his wife. And he told his wife off, and realized his wife was fast asleep. It wasn't her. And he saw it was his friend who died. But what really surprised him, this builder was wearing a polka dot bow tie and a nice suit. He said, this is weird, because I'd never seen in my life him wear this sort of clothing. And then he woke his wife up to say, this guy has come to see us. And of course, after he'd lost that one or two moments of contact, then she couldn't find him anymore. When he came and told me that story, I said, did you see him in his coffin? He said, no, it was a closed coffin. And I said, as soon as you can, please call his wife in Kalgoorlie, you know, he was living in Perth, and ask, just ask ordinary questions, and then just ask in passing, what was he wearing in his coffin? And that's when his wife admitted, said, oh, you know, I bought him this suit years ago. He never wore it, because, you know, just like ordinary Australian garb. And so I dressed him in a nice shirt, a polka dot bow tie, and this suit, because he would never wear it usually. Now he was dead, he couldn't complain. And that's exactly how he saw him in this vision. That happens a lot. That's just one story. That, you know, that this is like a mind-made body. So the consciousness creates that. It's not a real body, so you can put your hand through it if you wish. It's not scary, it's just mind-made. Then afterwards, they usually just go off into the next life. The conscious stream of consciousness, as they say, continues on. If they're enlightened, it stops. Okay, quickly, how to deal with self-frustration, how to deal with past series of mistakes and strong fear within oneself that makes us feel powerless about our future. How do you deal with self-frustration? It's like, what do you want? if you want something, you'd always be frustrated because you really feel that you've got the power to achieve that. A lot of times you don't. You think you're in control of stuff, and that's one of the big things which meditation does for you. When you try to control, it gets worse. When you learn how to let go, what does the word letting go mean? It's the opposite of controlling. So many times I've done this before, how to keep this water perfectly still. Control it? I can't do it. You put it down and it becomes still all by itself. Let go and you come to your default state, natural state. And so self-frustration means you haven't learned yet how to find peace and stillness, how to find even love and kindness. When you care for things rather than curing for things, it's amazing. Just all those things you tried hard to find through doing stuff, you find when you let go. You know that old simile which I've often said again, I'm really going over time this time. When you're chasing the carrot, the donkey chasing a carrot, how does the donkey catch the carrot? It stops. And then the carrot swings further away, and the donkey is patient enough to watch the carrot swing back towards it, and because of momentum, goes right into the donkey's mouth. You don't catch the donkey by chasing it, you catch the carrot through standing still. So then you know actually how to find peace. You make series of mistakes, wonderful. Mistakes are there to learn from, not to be ashamed of. And the mistakes should never make you afraid to learn to do it the proper way next time. And from UK, if we become peaceful and do not want anything, how do we choose things? You don't. Who wants to choose things? Such as a career. You don't, you do the default, you become a monk or a nun. Somewhere to live or people to be friends with. You find so many friends. If you're peaceful and kind and wise, you get too many friends. That's my problem now. I just find a way to escape. Look, I shouldn't say this, but after lunch in Bodhinyana Monastery, sometimes, you know, you've got to be kind, talk to people after lunch, but then, you know this Sarato, if you're my attendant, I look around and say, do you think we can escape now? And we look around, say, okay, let's give it a try. We bow three times and we get up, and as soon as I go to the door, more people come up. I don't mind, I'm just being honest with you, that's my life. So you try as best as you can to be kind and to serve whatever you can. But anyway, you try and do the best you can. This is weird questions, this is all the sort of meditation questions. Is that because of who's on the UV, the audio-visual thing today? Did you choose those questions?
No.
Really? That's weird. Okay. Anyway, I know you enjoy those type of questions. How do you block out desires for jhanas? Again, if you desire jhanas, deep meditations, you'll never get them. Desire means you're separated from where you want to be. That's suffering. Instead of doing that, you learn how to be peaceful. Not to have any desire at all. Just to sit there perfectly still. How can you be still when you have desire? Desire is what agitates the mind. So instead you sit there perfectly still, patiently wait. Ajahn Chah's simile, really over time. You don't pay anything, so I don't mind. I won't give you your money back. Ajahn Chah's simile of the mango orchard. Monastery was a mango orchard. The only way to catch those mangoes is to sit down perfectly still under the mango tree. That's all. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. That's how Ajahn Chah taught. I remember that. I thought it was crazy, it was mad teachings. But then, after a while, you realize that was totally true. If you try and climb the tree, you never reach the mangoes. Shake the tree, get a bomb and blow the tree up, the mangoes won't fall. But if you just sit there quietly, open up your hand, he said, I interpret that as kindness. Open the door of your heart, then mango will fall. Brilliant teaching. That's why many people don't get enlightened. They don't get jhanas. They're trying too hard. Doesn't matter how many times I'd say, that's not the way to get these deep meditations. They still keep on trying. Said, I'll give up so I can get a jhana. That's not giving up. You're letting go in order to get something. It's doing a business deal. No business deal. You sit there, calm, peaceful, and these things just fall into your hand. Okay, that's all the questions now. Can I go now? Was there any other questions anyone's got? Oh, Eddie, okay. Eddie got his hand up first of all. Look, if you have to leave, I quite expect, we're supposed to finish at 9 o'clock with the questions, but it's 9:20 now. If you're enjoying it, fine. Eddie, you can shout it, I'll repeat the answer. Okay, now, don't give poor old Bill a heart attack, Ronnie.
Actually, Ajahn Brahm, you know,
yeah,
inclusiveness is a very positive, you know, thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
It brings togetherness, yeah, you know, and what I mean is unity, you know, in unity we stand, in division we fall, you know. Don't you think the world now, you know, we lack all these things, you know, include like good things, you know. Our inclusiveness in the world includes inclusiveness to extend, you know, to gain power or to contain someone, all this negative inclusiveness, yeah, you know.
It is.
We lose a lot of all these things. Maybe it's through technology or what. We lose a lot of all this.
Yeah. So I think we're just feeling that our goal is all about power, prestige. We think we can fix the world. Instead of trying to fix the world, leave the world alone. Be care for the world, and it's a much better way of fixing it. The healing happens automatically when we let it happen, rather we make it happen. Yeah, go on.
Hello, Ajahn. did Ajahn Chah ever explain why he wanted you specifically to come to Australia? And the follow-up question would be, why Perth?
Why he didn't come to Australia is because there was no monastery in Australia when he had his stroke and couldn't travel at all. Because I remember coming here, when I came here for Waisak 1983, I think it was, and then just a couple of months later he had a stroke and couldn't speak anymore. So because of that, we hadn't got a monastery yet, we just had Magnolia Street, that's all. So we didn't get the monastery until December. So he didn't come here because there was nowhere to come. But I told the monks this, it's not really a secret. I remember a few years later, Ajahn Chah was still alive, but he couldn't travel, couldn't speak. I remember having this dream early in the morning of Ajahn Chah coming in my dream and giving me this Dhamma talk. It was brilliant. And I remember at the time I had enough awareness. It was in a dream, but I was like a lucid dream. And I heard him giving this amazing Dhamma talk. And I remember at the time I said, look, he's got a stroke, you know, this is so rare, it's just so precious. I must remember it. I was trying so hard to remember everything he said. And when I woke up, so the talk ended, you just woke up. And then I couldn't remember a thing. I was so disappointed. That would have been amazing, just, you know, almost like getting a sort of mind-to-mind Dhamma talk from Ajahn Chah when he had a stroke and couldn't speak. He was alive, but just not communicating. I couldn't remember a thing. That was just one of the most disappointing mornings of my life. That's why he couldn't come here. He wanted to keep carrying on, my goodness, okay.
Thank you for an amazing talk. I suppose, dovetailing on what you've just said, do you think that teaching is still with you? Subconsciously, part of whatever that Dharma talk was, it
that's
comes
interesting.
Through.
I can't really say.
It's still with you.
It's hard to actually to judge that. Is that Dharma talk still with me? And that was inspiring, but I think the disappointment afterwards was the only thing I really remember. Because you were aware enough when you were in this dream. It was at the end of a sleep. It wasn't sort of like a experience after a deep meditation. It was just a beautiful Dharma talk, and I just could not remember any of it. And I made a resolution several times during that talk, even though I was asleep. I remember that. I must remember this. anyway, maybe I think it was probably because I was trying too hard.
Yeah, well, exactly. I suppose what you were talking about is there was a question about whether you're thinking and you're listening to talks.
Indeed.
I suppose when you're giving talks, are you thinking or is it just a channel of consciousness? That's
weird. Can I be honest with you that when I give talks, I don't think?
Yeah, exactly. So it's weird. It's
I just allow one sort of sentence to come after another. I'm not channeling, it's just this stuff is just coming out. I don't think, what am I going to speak of next? It's weird, but I don't plan or think when I'm giving a talk. Okay, I think it's time to, this is I think a record, 24 minutes past 9 for a Friday night talk. So thank you all again for waiting and listening to this. Please remember, if you have to go early, it's all recorded, so you can get it later on if you wish. So now I pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sangang Namami